100 readings I've given. I've never read before people who are licking ice cream cones before. I think it goes along with the glitter. Chris brought glitter. It's all over us. I feel like Donovan. Well, just a word about how it's going to go this evening. I've done straight classical poetry readings, and I've done readings with musicians, and sometimes the musician will play three or four pieces, and then I'll dig through things and read things that respond to that, and then the musician will think of things and respond to that, and so on and so on. Sometimes it's just the music, and then it's just the poetry, or vice versa. This evening we're going to try something that's very different from any of those. You should think of these in couplets. And I don't want to tell you how to behave, because goodness knows you heard plenty of that last night. But rather than applaud after the poem, which typically we don't applaud until the poetry reading is done, I'll read a poem, and, I'm G. Barnes. I think I was supposed to say that for the tape. And if you want to say your name for the tape, just go ahead and do that now. So I'll read the poem, and then what's happened is I've handed the poems to the musician and the singer, and they've pulled together songs that seem to relate to those. They seem to be the same or similar somehow. So I'll read a poem, they'll do a song, and then I'll bet you want to applaud. And then I'll read a poem, and they'll sing a song, and then I'll bet you want to applaud. So that's the way we'll do that. There's a thing that poets do when they're reading stuff that people are unfamiliar with. It's called a gloss. And that means that when I come to a poem that has some stuff in it that, because you don't have the poem in front of you, you're not familiar with it, you don't have it on your shelf at home, there's some stuff that you may need to know that you haven't had to research or think through, or you haven't read it 15 times or something. So I'll just hit some of those things before reading some of the poems, if they seem to need a gloss to me. Looking at the first poem, I don't think it needs a gloss beyond saying that the speaker, it's in the first person, and when you read a poem that's in the first person, that's not necessarily completely the poet. In this case, it is rather me, because this poem was born not of my imagination, but of an actual experience. So the speaker, the persona in the poem, is rather me, and the other subject, the father, is rather my dad, but there are some changes in there too. It's called A Question of Timing. Water stood in a field up the bank behind us. I remember fishing with my father, his wide hands and the pole's cork handle. Three fingers under the grip, the index and thumb pinching lightly the colorless line. From time to time, he checked the minnow bucket. It was perforated. It sat in the river's edge. Where it dipped into the water on its way over to the knotty, exposed roots of a tree, the cord had gone all yellow. The minnows were always okay, flashing silver in their little piece of river. Kids are torn. They want to hold minnows, and they want to let them go. And Dad stood in the shadows while I sat on the bank. Out front, time rode woven in the river. Afterwards, we drove up the rutted road toward the highway, our fish in a bucket in the back. My father's pant legs were wet up to his knees. He lit a cigarette, cupping his hands around the paper match, elbows on the wheel. He shifted down, and the car lurched around the corner. As we made the pavement, and he eyed the mirror, I turned to face him fully. I thought he was going to say something. They were going to introduce themselves, but since they didn't, would you please welcome with more than that applause, some more applause, Chris Hendrickson and David Campbell. This was written in Kansas, as the title might suggest. It's an extended metaphor. I'll just unleash what that metaphor is so we don't have to be puzzling all night. The Martins are us. And I would consider this one of my most Christian poems. Some are decidedly Christian and some are kind of sliding and then some are real secular. Let's see, a couple of things that might need a gloss. I find that a lot of people don't know what a contrail is. Do you know what that is? Mm-hmm. What is it? Yeah, it says jet stripes that they need, okay. So when they come to that, thumbnail paring, do you know what that is?
No.
Okay, it's when you trim your nails in that little round shape that's left off that you shouldn't leave on the floor, by the way. You know, you should put it. Stepping on it bare feet in the morning is not good. I once dated a girl in high school, and her father always trimmed his nails on Saturday evening before church the next morning, and then he left them by the couch on the floor. So that's what a thumbnail paring is. I think that's all you need to know before we hear it. The title is a list. It just means to establish when and where we are. Saturday, September, sunset, Kansas. 90 brown plain martens measured out along a rope. Beads strung upon this prairie telephone line. Each narrow breast is turned towards our road. Every pecan nut brain in every head swelled with bird dreams of wild winging soon, while feasting on mosquitoes midair, snap rolling, exploding in every direction. 5 miles above, an unseeable jet struggles west, contrail fingers scraping hard against the azure canopy, the dome of the one world of us all. Near these scratches, the moon is a farmer's thumbnail paring, or God's. And we are all of us clinging, wind at our backs, suspended just ahead of real dark. We wait on a merciful meal, just enough at least to tug us into whatever sleep awaits. When our own moments ripen perfectly and burst forth without a sound, and burst forth without a sound.
I've looked at clouds that way.
Thank you for coming this evening. I know there's loads going on in the village, and thank you for being here. This one's going to take a little glossing, I'm sorry. I've long, before it kind of became fashionable to be, and before Van Gogh's painting began to sell for $26 and $52 million and stuff, I've long been a fan of the life and the work of Van Gogh, and I commend to you any translation you can find of a book that I know the title of as Dear Theo. Van Gogh was not only an exceptional artist, visual artist, but he was also an exceptional writer in the form of letters to his brother. Van Gogh, born in Holland, was early called into lay ministry, went to, I think, Belgium, took everything very seriously and literally from the Bible. He had the clothes he had on. He ate only what people gave him. He slept in the straw with the animals. He got very, very ill with illnesses that plagued him, physical illnesses that plagued him lifelong, in addition to mental illness, which struck him later. After this, he took up drawing and painting, eventually moving to Paris. His brother Theo had moved there earlier to be an art dealer, work in an art gallery. And then Van Gogh became friends with Gauguin. Gauguin said, let's move to the south of France because the light is so wonderful. So they moved to these little villages, and Van Gogh would live in one room. Theo would send him money regularly with which he would buy paint and so on, very little food. And he lived very simply on an almost kind of starvation diet. That's when he entered some real manic phases, and you know about the ear, et cetera, et cetera. That's what everybody thinks about when they think about Van Gogh. He was befriended by a doctor, was institutionalized in a sanitarium for a while, a couple of times. Would paint there, would come out, would paint better, would paint worse, would go back, et cetera. You may know some of these things. In his last about 70 days, he painted 70 paintings. He also did a number of drawings. Eventually, as this manic phase, you know, of sleepless nights, lots of smoking tobacco, loads and loads of coffee, also some alcohol, He shot himself. And when he came to a group of people sitting outside at a restaurant that was a cafe, and said, I've hurt myself or I've shot myself, went up the stairs. The doctor was summoned, but he was not able to be revived, and he died. Within about a couple of months or 6 months, his brother Teo died. And they are buried in a very simple cemetery with just marble slabs, Vincent van Gogh, Teo van Gogh. And if you see portraits of the, or photographs of this or in movies, vines have grown over the two of them together. They had a lifelong bond. Teo, the supporter of the art and the understander of the art, and Van Gogh, the producer of the art. It may be that Van Gogh sold one painting, but even that is questionable during his lifetime. After that, Teo's wife kept the paintings and the letters, tried as best she could to get something going with those. Almost nothing happened still, and it wasn't until modern times that 100 years later, more than 100 years later, that things really began kind of cooking. This poem is built in form on kind of a strangeness. It has three stanzas. The first two, the first one is kind of a peaceable time for Van Gogh, in a depressing but peaceable, tranquil kind of state. The second one enters the manic state, and it's a cantilever kind of construction. It's not a post-Millennial construction or a Gothic arch or anything like that. You know, cantilever was invented by Frank Lloyd Wright, where you've got an upright and then like a whole lot of deck out here and then a house here, so that it works, you know. And hopefully the fulcrum of the piece comes down here to the end when it's made personal. A reminder from my own childhood as I was writing the poem itself. I want to say that I wish that I thought ahead enough to include this in Anna's memorial last week, because she was also very attached to Van Gogh, and this song coming up speaks to her very much. And the poem was one that she both feared and loved. But I wish that the song in particular had been used during that service. Is there anything else you need to know from here? You'll recognize snatches of some of the paintings in here if you're familiar with this book at all. Oh, a standard course in art college is called life drawing. It's drawing from life, whether that be nudes or fruit bowls or whatever it is. But the title means more than life drawing. Life drawing. Sunday, Van Gogh strolls in the garden, smiling thinly while listening to the reports of laughter of friends and family exploding, then drifting across the lawn. Later, he draws on his pipe, seeing his relations off from the station for their Paris home. He waves once, turns, tucks his hands into his jacket pockets, and strides away, fingering the 50-franc note pressed routinely on him by Brother Teo. His pipe goes out. Monday, Van Gogh goes to the shop for pigment, canvas, terp, knives, keeping notes, as always, on the money's going. These figures he sets down in the letters to his brother. That week, he paints vases, houses, that girl at the piano before the busy wallpaper, the one of the doctor. The other with the red bedrobe and the plank floor of his tiny room gone 100 colors. Standing where the roads cross, he paints the empty church and the dwellings of his neighbors. He surveys again the wheat fields, blowing their high yellow note, the sky this time breathing the bass lines, purple and hung with crows. When a child, I stumbled upon a wide, lovely, furry cat napping in the weeds beside the road. Its eyes were closed, its body nestled down into the land. A stretched moment, it held me. Then I hopped back, jolted by wrongness. I froze, then reached toward the still thing once, thinking to touch it. But now, finding a stick, I poked, then pried it over. Boiling inside were so many maggots. Bones, guts, heart, brain, all gone. But for the perfect seeming canvas cat, a shell of skin.
Colors changing, blind and pain. ever will.
It always feels terrific to work with other artists. Of such high devotion and caliber. Excuse me. This is the newest poem, which I'll start reading once my eyes clear. Each stanza, except for the first one, begins with the word "or," and each stanza should be seen as a painting of some size. Some of the paintings are longer, and some of the paintings are just, you know, some of the paintings are big ones, and some of the paintings are little ones. It's one of those poems where the first line feeds right in, the title feeds right into the first line, okay? And the poem hopes to prove the title. I should say that people sometimes ask, why do poets read so funny? And I won't pretend that I haven't been asked that question before. And so my answer has been, and I think I'll just stand by it, we're trying to give the words their best chance. Okay? There's a dedication on this one. It's dedicated for Anne, for Aaron and Anna. The title is, I should mention that we were married in Hong Kong, and that the children are born there. Anna was born at home. I was the doctor. Aaron was born in a hospital because that was the law, but I was almost a doctor. And I don't see anything else that needs glossing. Choosing names for the children. We did it in bed. Filled with awe and love and fear. How apt. Under those same quilt blocks, yellow and red and blue, purple, green, and patterned. Between the same wide white sheets, where they each were conceived in their turns, by our turnings, strokings, searchings, swimmings, caresses and kisses, reachings for air. Your hair, first a lake on the pillow, then a river, then a waterfall above me, then the sea. Or we did it while seated together in a sitting room among the guitars and books and many palms and other houseplants, the twilight glowing on the eastern wall, the candles, the kerosene lamp, the enormous globe of Japanese paper. Or swaying crazily, clutching at the chrome bar of the flesh-colored seat back in front of us as we rode the top level of the double-decker bus, careening around the curves of the too narrow road, the ocean down one side, the lush mountain growth stabbing up the other, headed back to our fishing village from some trip to town, where we'd searched out and purchased baby things, little clothes, mosquito netting, big bundles of those old-style square cotton diapers. We'd propose names, one to the other. If it's a girl, if it's a boy again, what then? Serious tries, or jokey ones sometimes, when we were tired from the push of the crowds downtown. Or walking by the big pale rocks, hard and smooth as your belly, a belly swelling like the bay curved before us, our knees weak with walking, your breath labored and your nostrils offended by the heavy stench of kelp drying in the sun on a stone seawall and the rice wine press a few steps up the narrow street. My brother's names, your mother's, perhaps your great-grandmother's, pronounced the way they had back in Norway. Your family name before the one we shared now. I remember how earnest we were, how young. I knew it then. How shall we pull this off? I puzzled. All of it. I knew you wondered too. Choosing a name a child will carry for life, the raising of them right. I knew you held a faith I could not fathom. Perhaps I said so. I really don't recall. So many questions in those ripe moments. Any answers lying far ahead. Or driving in the tiny English Morris Minor car, top down, we try naming them. Just driving to drive through cool salt air, going no place, but getting somewhere. Or under canopies of frangipani and flame of the forest trees, amidst the garden's potted flowers and fern fronds spiking wild from the ground, talking of something else, one of us would suddenly suggest another name. Once, among long but tangled thoughts, I was taken again by the sight of your fine blonde hair lifting on a sudden breeze, as though giving shape to the light wind, really. While we sat close, your left thigh just pressing my right, on that park bench of chipped green paint, plain dirt at our feet, wondering again, twisted up with wonder, and knowing right in the middle of the moment, watching your lips move, that I was to burst almost with wonder, with the wonder of naming babies, with the color of your straight hair, transparent nearly as any wind, with the breeze, the spirit, the hair floated on. And I knew you were surging inside with sea.
Pictures of the children, the flies. having nervous breakdowns. They're always taking pills to make them feel the otherwise. How could I ever stumble or complain that things aren't going right? How could I ever fail to see rainbows in the sky? And it makes it hard when I close my eyes and I can see the pictures taken at Botswana, the pictures of the children, the flies in their eyes. Oh, favored is the fire, and it's fanned by the winds of fate. Well, I'm worried of our numbers, I'm worried of our ranks, as we fire up the Porsches and fighting to survive, as we look for valet parking out on Rodeo Drive. And it makes it hard, I wonder if God cries when he sees the pictures taken at Botswana, the pictures of the children, the flies in their eyes. And I'm not my brother's keeper, for I do not have the power. Is it part of some great game that they play on the other side? 'Cause it's all that I can do to just keep myself together. And still I see the faces, the blue Pacific tide, and it makes it hard when I close my eyes. And I can see the pictures taken at Botswana, the pictures of the children, the flies in their eyes. Is it not for us to wonder, not for us to question? Is it not for us to cry out, this cannot be denied? For we are but a family without walls, but we have waters in every face you see. And it is you, and it is I, and it makes it hard when you close your eyes and you can see the pictures taken at Botswana, the pictures of the children, the flies in their eyes. The pictures of the children, the flies in their eyes.
Now, a confession is needed for this one, and then one tiny gloss. It'll be this one, and then two short ones. The confession is, well, I'm from Kansas, so.
You're forgiven.
It doesn't take, I'm forgiven, he said. It doesn't take much to impress me, and we have to look really hard to find something to look at. And I know a lot of people consider us flyover people. You've heard that term. People from the coast think we're just the people they fly over when they're going. And the land looks a lot the same unless you really study it. Well, linked to that confession is this confession. Sometimes especially when I'm driving, some really dumb piece of land or dumb outcrop or, you know, I just fall in love with. I just fall madly in love with instantaneously. And I remember it forever. And it's a piece of land, usually, that nobody can do anything with. They can't develop it. They don't want to put a McDonald's on it. You know, it's just too ugly, you know, for that. They don't want to put a town there. And if I ever happen to be riding with somebody, they can't understand what I'm talking about when I say, look at that.
And, what?
So this is such a poem. It's called Something for Nothing. And then the only gloss you need, which links to our song, is that it was on the way back from the very first cowboy poetry gathering in 1985, I guess, in Elko, Nevada. And I had a passenger with me whom I did not really know, a colleague of mine. And I'd been hearing Ian Tyson, the Canadian country singer, Western singer. And he'd been singing a song called Double Diamond, which was about the breakup of a huge ranch that straddled Wyoming and Colorado, the Double Diamond Ranch, a song called The Old Double Diamond. And so that figures in here. So this is Something for Nothing. Under caps of lumpy, frozen snow, the sage along the road has become cauliflower. The land lies in soft wrinkles, and the sky is tugged behind the mountains, dim and waiting at the horizon. It is snowing again. 30 miles ago, sheep and ponies stood together in a pen with thick white shawls crusted to their backs. And we passed something black frozen to the shoulder of the freeway. We consider turning on the radio, but I have Ian singing Double Diamond in my head and don't want to give it up. Seeing a particular rise in the land, I take to it, remembering this feeling I've had before in other places. Places unspectacular on the surface, but seem somehow holy anyway, and stay in me against all odds. All of it, the scrubby plants, the huddled animals, the snow in the road, the wind, the sky, the frozen land, strikes me as precious, handsome in ways I can't explain. I try. But you can't be blamed that the colors drained from your voice. I've heard the same from others. There's nothing here. Mm-hmm. And that is all.
To break the silence and show that I really can talk. And break one of my rules. I normally don't say who I learn a song from, because once I learn it, I consider it mine. But in this case, it really wasn't Ian Tyson's song that sparked this one off to be doing here. So. Thank you.
heard you left the Chinanea. Well, it makes me kind of sad. She's a great old Spanish land grant. You're about the best she's ever had. The cowboys and the corporations seem to naturally collide. And you came out the loser with your damned old cowboy pride. Cowboy pride'll always get a man through, but sometimes it makes a fool of you. Good women are hard to find. Talking about the faithful kind. Now you're running with that waitress.
See that we've kind of moved from the serious kind of over to things that are a little less serious, and things that are contemplative in different kinds of ways, different shapes. This is one that needs not much gloss. It has to do with coming up the lake one time years ago, so many years ago that whole one side had been burned down. And the eastern or the northern side, wherever you are on the lake. The metaphor in it has to do with this lushness on one side of the lake, you know, that thing that can be on one side of our lives, this barrenness that can be on another side of our lives, and how we can be moving through something, just moving through those two things. And that kind of comes to you in the closing stanza. It's got a lot of little snapshots in it. I've referred to some pieces as paintings, and some other poems are drawings, and some pieces are big, you know, they're murals. This has got a bunch of little Polaroids in the middle of it. And then it gets to kind of the moral at the end. It's called Amidst Ship. He could tell the water wanted to be ice. Standing at the rail, he watched the dark lake open for the white hull, then looked up to catch the timber rising up the mountain sides to a sky tucked hard behind. Opposite, hills stripped bare by fire lolled off to the horizon. People, mail, potatoes, crates of eggs and yellow onions, and some buckets of cut flowers. Earlier, he'd watched men onload these and made a list. People to cabins, mail and gray canvas, the rest stacked on the after deck and webbed over with stout nets. Now, the water closed tight behind, and the wind. No prints to trace. There are moments hung like vessels between promises and scars.
You have ever
I've found my occupational hazard being an occupation just not around. Feel like I've drowned.
This far together, we can do this one. I have to say, I have no idea how this poem got written. It started out goofy and just kept getting goofier. A bunch of the stuff in it actually happened to me at the top, but then there was a life in the language that just kind of ran away somewhere and just kind of went to heck. I don't know. And I have no idea. This was in some options, you know, the options. This has two folders in it, and we had some that we knew, and then this was in the options. And David said, "Oh, I've got a song that goes with that, but I don't know what it's going to be. I can't even imagine what he's going to put with this." So. It'll be good. Even the title on this one's Daffy. I'm trying to gloss it, but I'm just going to have to leave it to you to figure out where it begins to break down from reality into something, you know. It's called Things I Have Found in the Grass During My Lifetime Up to Now. That got such a good reaction, I'm going to repeat it. Things I have found in the grass during my lifetime up to now. A baby cottontail, born early, haired out, and frozen. I was 10. Pieces of machines, objects left by Indians, a number of bird eggs, my last when I was 35, before that 20 years, whole flocks every spring, they were of several colors, broken glass, 15 quarters, other coins. Out in a field, away from anywhere, a 1913 magazine in good condition. On the cover was a sailboat, inside an advertisement for a new invention, the zipper. A stringy thing resembling exactly an antique buffalo lip. From the Vatican catalog, I special ordered one of their boxes for finger bones of saints. I went deluxe, sprang for the pine lined in blue silk. When it came, I opened it and found the silkworm just finishing up. I dropped in the lip and slid shut the little lid. Yesterday, I went out and hid it in the grass.
Basically, the connection is grass and Donovan.
Hi.
thanks again for coming, and please give another round of applause for David and for Chris. You can do us a favor if you will steal the signs for this concert. So otherwise, we're going to have to go around and take them all down tomorrow.
Collector's items.
You might want to have Chris and David sign them or something.
I'll get you. Work the money in 10 years.